Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of Edict, brought to you by Castle of Commons. This week, me and my co-host Job are going to be breaking down the Rags to Riches 22. We're going to be doing a metagame breakdown, talking about some of the interesting decks that showed up, as well as doing some commentary and gunning through the feature matches that we saw throughout the night. So, if you're interested, come along, sit back, relax, as we dictate a royal decree on this week's Edict. One more quick note before we get into the episode proper. This is a Card Kingdom paper event, and Card Kingdom does have their own slightly altered ban list for the Pauper format. They are having any card available at Common, paper, and online legal within their Pauper format, and this is a slightly altered ban list to the one available on MTGO. So, if you guys are interested in reading up more specifically about their ban list, I will put a link in the show notes for you guys to read up on their ban list specifically, but keep that in mind as we are going to occasionally be talking about some paper-only specials as we move through this episode. Thank you, and let's jump into the show.
Okay, and let's get into it. So, this was Rags to Riches 22, hosted by Card Kingdom at Mox Boarding House, one of them? I believe it's...
22 Mox.
Yeah.
Oh, Seattle was the location, yeah.
Yeah, Mox Boarding House, Seattle. Because they have two stores and they differentiate them. So this one was a bit of an interesting tournament. The winner was Travis Hobria piloting a Jeskai Familiars deck. And it was a bit of an interesting list and went, I believe, undefeated through the entire tournament, not counting draws. That he drew a few matches, but he never had a actual game loss through the entire tournament.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that's due to the style of deck and the way it's trying to play, right? We see with this deck, it's leaning very hard on God Pharaoh's Faithful and gaining an extremely high amount of life and just not losing the game and hoping that that's enough to win it.
Oh, yeah. And he even said in a short interview after the tournament was over that... he was able to change up one or two cards and that in the future he would change up one or two cards additional because of paper. Being in paper, winning through infinite life is a much more consistent way to win than online, where online just demonstrating the loop is not always enough for people. Whereas in paper, you can just demonstrate the loop, say, I'm at a trillion, and then the opponent has to deal with that, and it's not you spending 10 minutes doing different clicks going through the cycle to gain life slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to worry so much about, hey, is my clock ticking while I'm trying to gain an arbitrarily large amount of life? That's why we see stuff like Sage's Road Engine played a lot more online, so that you can actually get that kill condition in place.
Yeah, whereas I think he said he would even just cut the Sage's Row entirely from the 75 in paper for future tournaments, because he just doesn't win that way. It doesn't come up. I think he won one match through that the entire tournament.
Yeah, it's much more for online play.
The rest of the field for the tournament was a bit interesting. In addition to the winner, we had Tortured Existence actually coming in at the most represented deck archetype in the tournament with 5 out of a 55 player field. And for Pauper being a ridiculously diverse format, that somewhere it was just over 23% of the field was on unique decks. Having 5 is a lot, but no Tortured Existence deck even made top 16. So it really was not a Tortured Existence tournament, even though the players were there. They just didn't get very far.
Yeah, and we see a lot of strange pickups in the popular decks, like Bogless is also very high as well, which you don't see very much online. There's stuff like Mono Black Control, which it's not as popular online, it doesn't succeed nearly as much as it does, but something like Tireless Tribe, which does do very well online and top 3 the last challenge, we do see that as a much lower value at only 2 people playing that.
Yeah, we had 3 Boggles decks in the top 16, which is not traditional of online tournaments at all. So they're definitely
2 Boggles in the top 8.
Yeah, there definitely seem to be some nods to online as opposed to paper play going on in the tournament. We had next most represented, we had Boggles tied at 4 with Mono Blue Delver and Boros Monarch. Both had 4 players in the field. Burn, Elves, Blue Black Delver, Blue Black Control, Mono Blue Delver, Stompy, sort of going down the list. Slivers had two, Tron had two, and Izzet Delver had two. It definitely is a little bit weird to see that Izzet Delver was actually the least represented of the Delver variants, when it's generally considered to be the strongest deck in the format, that it is a deck with no bad matchups.
It's represented at 6.9% right now on the MTG Goldfish site, so it's certainly a top contender in the online meta.
Yeah. For a deck that is as unquestionably powerful as Izzet Delver is, to have two players out of a 55-player field is definitely a bit odd. I do think that might not be entirely correct, as during the tournament, I believe it happened actually more than once where mid-match we would figure out that a Delver deck was actually blue-black or blue-red when they had been put into the system as mono-blue. So considering that this chart that I pulled was from before the tournament actually started, before pre-round one, that metagame breakdown may not be entirely correct, that we may be working with a few extra Izzet Delver list. And that may have just been due to sort of clerical errors when they put in sheets.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of issues with getting the results for this tournament and getting, you know, that sort of, are we really sure about what exactly we're looking at in terms of the data for this stuff? So grain of salt for pretty much everything we say on this stuff.
Yeah. One thing that I definitely found interesting was the general lack of control that we saw, that the only real control decks that we see out of the name decks that were not the unique decks, we had two Tron decks and two blue-black control. And that was it as far as true control. Sometimes Tortured Existence decks can be considered control decks. Sometimes mono-black control, people can argue for that, but it's more of a mid-range deck. That it's blue-black Delver can sideboard into control if it really needs to, but we really didn't have a lot of true control decks showing up in the field.
Yeah, the top 16 is extremely aggressive. You know, you've got multiple instances of Boggles, you've got Izzet Blitz, you've got Tyler's Tribe in there, you've got mono blue Delver, which can play very aggressively. You know, it seems like a very, I don't want to say cutthroat, but very aggressive top 16.
Yeah, I definitely think that the lack of much control decks on the field out of the 55 players for the tournament definitely warped the top 16 a bit. That if we had seen a few more control decks, I think that it definitely would have changed what we would have seen higher up the ladders. Even if those decks didn't make top 16, I think them knocking out some of these aggressive decks from getting there would have been a difference we would have seen if we had seen a few more control decks come up. But I think this was definitely an aggro tournament more than we have seen in the past.
Definitely. So as we discussed earlier, our winner was on UI Familiars, Travis Hobria. Following that, we had Boggles by William Ghostware. Then we had Izzet Delver by Peter Yee. Slivers by Joe Palmier. Blue Delver by John Richardson. Boggles by Mac Green. Deep Hours Aggro by Alonzo Sistonas. And UB Delver by Teddy Vitro.
And an interesting note is that Deep Hours Aggro is, I would call, a different deck than a Mono Blue Delver deck. So that is a different deck than the others that we've seen.
Yeah, it definitely plays a very different plan, actually. The one you're referring to, I believe, is the Blue Delver by John Richardson, actually.
Is that?
Yeah, I think
MTG
so.
MTG Top 8 is a wonderful system.
Yeah, that's the one with a lot of strange picks. Like, going into this deck a little bit, it's running four Elusive Spellfist, one Vault Scourge, four Unstable Mutation, one Bone Splitter, two Mutagenic Growth. It's running stuff like Outwit in the sideboard. Tormod's Crypt is a paper inclusion that they get to pick up. Distortion Strike, an extra Bone Splitter out of the sideboard, Fate Transfer. So we see a lot of extremely aggressive options that kind of push us more towards a blue stompy flavor than a traditional tempo style of mono blue Delver.
Yeah,
Deep Hours Aggro keeps more of a traditional style for the list.
Yeah, this was definitely an interesting deck when it showed up on stream. that when this one hit the feature match area, sort of everybody was a bit surprised by what was going on there. Seeing, because the commentators had the list, but often weren't looking at them, were generally seeing that, oh, this was a mono blue Delver list and taking it at face value. And then we started seeing some of these odd cards show up, and it drew some attention and raised some questions that were going on there.
Yeah, for people like myself who don't know off the top of their head, Outwit is an instant one blue counter target spell that targets a player. So I think we're seeing this out of the board for stuff like Burn, I would imagine. Maybe Edicts.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what that is specifically targeting. Because there's... I can't remember the name of it. I'm going to have to look it up. But we have the one blue counter spell to counter a spell that targets a permanent you control.
Mm-hmm. Which is definitely a much wider option, right? So the only thing I can think of that would get around that the other one doesn't is stuff like burn spells going straight to face. And we don't even actually see that much burn in the total breakdown. It's only three decks.
So. No, burn shows up a pretty decent amount online, but it was not a huge contender at this tournament in particular.
The other thing you can kind of see that it could maybe be attributed towards is a fling out of affinity. Because we can see there's a number of players that are kind of hedging a bit more than is traditionally standard against affinity. We think that maybe that was due to maybe last tournament or the local play group plays a lot more affinity, that kind of thing.
Yeah, if I remember right, the last Rags to Riches had a decent amount of affinity show up, that elves and affinity were a pretty big part of the field. So,
like, for example, in Depowers Aggro by Alonso Sirstanis, we see double Gorilla Shaman out of the board, as well as stuff like Hydro Blast, which is just generally good. But yeah, double Gorilla Shaman is a bit more than we would normally expect.
So, anything else?
Nothing huge. We talked a little bit about before the show. The second Boggles list by Mark Green is running... sort of an interesting land base. It's got all snow-covered lands. I think that's just sort of to pimp things out. But it's also running an Ash Barrens, which we usually don't see out of these kind of lists. It's usually just a mixture of, like, Blossoming Sands for your gain lands, a couple Kalini Garden, and then your usually some utility lands.
I know the Familiars deck is actually running snow lands as well, and I think that does serve somewhat of a purpose.
Mm-hmm. That if you opening a snow covered island,
yeah, opening a snow covered island is definitely gonna trigger some players to start playing the game a certain way. So I think that while it might not come up a whole lot, I think that playing snow lands out of that deck serves a purpose. Whereas, yeah, I think in Boggles it's just for show.
And then the other one was the two Selesnya Sanctuary out of Joe Pomier's Slivers deck. It was number four on our top eight.
Yeah, this was an interesting include, as I've played a decent amount of Slivers online, and you really, really need to start presenting pressure by turn three. That you need to have four fours by turn three. That's really what you want to be doing. And Selesnya Sanctuary and the bounce land means that if your opening hand is any tapped land and a Selesnya Sanctuary as your lands, you are not doing anything till turn three at the minimum. And that's just not going to get you anywhere quickly.
Yeah, the deck runs 8 tapped lands out of 21 lands, and I think that's a lot more than I would really feel comfortable running. Kalini Garden's a must. And Blossoming Sands are a pretty standard feat of this this type of list, but having that extra pair without them adding any real utility is kind of awkward.
Yeah, you'll see cycling lands or Guildgate or equivalent just come to play tap lands sometimes as a fifth and sixth copy of sort of either a dual land or sometimes they'll run the cycling lands for late game utility. But yeah, Selesnya Sanctuary, the bounce land, is definitely an odd include and not something we see a whole lot. It's not something I like personally. They did fairly well in the tournament, obviously, but it's generally a bit of an odd include, all things considered, with what the deck is trying to do, getting coming out of the gate so fast. The bounce land seems to slow it down more than I feel like it might want to.
Yeah. The other thing I want to mention in this list is it's running two standard bearers in the main. I think this might be a bit of a cave to the fact that it's running a slightly slower land base, that it's expecting to be hit by more removal. So I think those could be pretty valuable against a number of decks.
Yeah, assume the game is going to go a few turns longer than it normally would have, so I need to keep my guys alive.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Keep your key slivers alive and try and maintain that board presence through removal.
With that out of the way, let's do a quick rundown of some of the matches themselves. I took some notes going through the tournament itself, sort of each of our feature matches, and we'll run through quickly some of the interesting matches that showed up on camera during the tournament. Round one, we had Boros versus Abzan Tortured Existence. It was a really, really long game one. Tortured Existence looked to have the game pretty well locked up for most of the game, but ended up just blanking on some draws later, and Boros doing what Boros does. It gained Monarch and slowly clawed its way back in with card advantage and running 16 bolts.
Yeah, I think in this one it's going to be that same kind of matchup of if you can survive long enough, you can really just get your way back into the game through enough removal and stuff like, you know, your draw spells, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Boros is definitely a very resilient deck, and having so much burn that can act as burn to be win conditions or as removal, and this burn and this player in particular definitely made the correct decision early on to sort of pivot, saving their burn for a win con instead of removal, because against something like Tortured Existence, removal is a speed bump. It's a minor inconvenience, not a permanent fix to problems. One interesting card we did see that was a new card in the Tortured Existence list was Moodmark Painter, and it did do some pretty decent work. It was exiled due to a Journey to Nowhere later in the match, but he did cast it several times before it got there, and managed to kill quite a few creatures.
Yeah, that was one of the ones I was really looking forward to seeing somewhere in the meta following Guild of Ravnica, and I'm really glad to see that that made its way into a Tordex deck that can really use that type of effect very well.
Yeah, I think playing against Boros is definitely one of the worst-case scenarios for Moodmark Painter, because it's one of the only decks in the main board that has a way to exile it. That playing against pretty much anything else that doesn't have a way to exile it main board, you're just going to be able to continue to recast it, sag it to Carrion Feeder, and just keep saying, I'm going to do 16 to you, can you answer it every turn?
Yeah, definitely Menace is a lot less valuable against a deck like Boros that can put out a whole bunch of bird tokens and just find ways to put two and two together and get enough of a blocker in front of it, but I'd really like to see that and how it performs against other decks that have more trouble putting multiple blockers on a creature.
Oh yeah, the Tortured Existence deck going up against Boros round one was definitely a bad luck of the draw for it, but I think it was definitely a decent list overall, and it is one that I am interested in seeing that list evolve moving forward. So moving on to round two, this was a Tireless Tribe versus Slivers matchup. The Slivers deck did end up coming out ahead, and that was even after a mulligan to 5 on the part of Slivers game 2. So that was a bit of an impressive showing on the Slivers part for that in particular.
Yeah, it's definitely the kind of deck that really only needs a few pieces to really get going. You know, if you get a couple of your core Slivers together and you can start making pretty serious threats. I guess Tribe just didn't get a very good start off that one. Tribe can be a very swingy deck in terms of whether or not it gets the pieces it needs in its opening hand or is able to find them in its first few cantrips. After that, it kind of gets a bit suspect in terms of being able to put together a combo without your opponent interacting with it.
Oh yeah, Tribe eventually just scooped on game 3 because it just couldn't find a Tribe. It had all of the combo pieces, it had a bunch of land, it was ready to go, and just could not find the Tireless Tribe to actually combo off. And at that point, it was late enough in the game that Slivers was presenting 12 damage a turn.
Yeah, that's definitely a rough shake for that that style of deck.
So next up, we have a Jeskai Familiars versus Blue-Black Delver. And this one ended up going 2-0 to the Jeskai Familiars. This was the, I believe, only time in the tournament that I saw the Denizen win, where I saw them actually mill out their opponent with the Denizen.
Yeah, it definitely shows what the deck can really do in an online setting, right? Where it just assembles what it needs, the pieces it needs, and just starts getting your deck out of there with the Denizen.
Oh yeah, that blue-black Delver can present a lot of damage. That between Flyers in the Air and Gurmag Anglers, you can do a lot of damage once you get into the mid to late game off of a blue-black Delver list. But you can't kill infinite life. And that really was his game plan, is he spent the entirety of the early game working on just building up a toolbox, just a few pieces to get that infinite life. And once that comes online, Delver has no answers.
Yeah, it definitely shows what that style of deck, like the familiar style deck, can really do against decks that don't take it out of the game incredibly quickly. And even a deck like Blue-Black Delver, which can usually do that, it has a lot of tools like Stonehorn Dignitary that allow it to kind of slow down the game enough that it can get what it needs in order to finish out the game.
Yeah, and speaking of Stonehorn Dignitary, that's a bit of an odd include, so we'll read that one off. That is a 3-mana 4/1. 3 colorless and 1 white mana. When Stonehorn Dignitary enters the battlefield, target opponent skips his or her next combat phase, which ideally is going to be looking to flicker its creatures multiple times in a turn. You can stack these. And when you combo off, when you're getting a situation where you are going off and you're playing Ghostly Flicker however many times you want a turn, you can just flicker this and say that your opponent doesn't get to play the game anymore.
Yeah, being able to stack up combat phases that your opponent doesn't get to take in a row lets you kind of play around stuff like edicts and removal that would be able to get rid of that fairly tough body of 1/4, right?
Oh, yeah.
Even though it's coming down on turn 4 at 3 and a white, it's definitely enough to slow down a game once you get your engine around Ghostly Flicker together.
And that's not including the fact that just the God Pharaoh's... What's it? God Pharaoh's...
God Pharaoh's Faithful is a white for a 1/4. No, 0/4.
Yeah. The God Pharaoh's Faithful being an 0/4 for 1 mana is a lot of not just actual toughness to fight through, but the fact that it also gains you life for casting your spells means that in addition to just having a 4 toughness creature in play on turn 1 or turn 2, you now have to deal with the fact that it's gaining this incremental life gain that will eventually turn into infinite life later in the game.
Yeah, it's an extremely powerful defensive option, and whenever you're looking at a set and you see a card that says, whenever something happens, do this, that's always a very powerful card that you have to pay attention to.
Next up for round 4, we had a Mono Blue Delver deck versus Boggles. Boggles ended up picking up the win, 0-2, and this was the first time we saw this more aggressive, stompy-style Delver list in the tournament. Stacked with things like Vault Scourge and the Unstable Mutation, lower days count than we traditionally see out of Delver decks, only having one among the 75. This was definitely a interesting matchup to see, as both of these decks are coming out of the gate so hard and so fast, but with Delver not having any way to deal with Boggles once they hit the board, it just did not go well for it the longer the game went on.
Yeah, I think another important aspect to this matchup is stuff like life gain out of Boggles, because Delver really doesn't have a way to interact with those enchantments once they hit the board, right? You put on something like Armadillo Armor, and it's you're gaining life every turn off that big swing, and Delver really can't keep up with that.
Oh yeah, and this being a much more aggressive style of Delver, you're definitely you're racing more than you normally are with a Delver deck. A normal Delver deck, you're racing, but you're much more willing to let the game go a little bit longer because you know you have the counter spells, you have the card draw to fight it when you get a little bit later into the game. Whereas with this version of the list, you really need the game to end a bit sooner. And if you can't quite get there, if the draws aren't lining up, or if your opponent's drawing well off the top, if you can't end it quickly, you're going to start getting outclassed by the creatures and the spells out of Boggles.
Yeah, the threat that Boggles can really build up against a deck like Delver is really difficult for them to overcome.
So next up, we have our Jeskai Familiars deck versus Blue-Black Delver, this one going 2-0-2 Familiars. This was the first time that I, at least on stream, noticed the Snowlands showing up, even though this was a deck that doesn't actually include any Snow Matters cards in it. And this was important to note because up to this point, most of the players didn't know what other players were playing. That once you got into the top 16, top 8, players knew what other players were playing, but at this point in the tournament, we're still early on in the rounds, and you didn't know what you're up against. So seeing the Snowlands come out and sort of surprising people a little bit was an interesting include in that deck.
Yeah, it's a pretty standard tactic that we see with a lot of decks that run either blue or red, you know, to try and throw off your opponent's early plays in a couple first couple turns, you know. If they're doing a cantrip or they're digging for stuff and they want to try and prepare themselves for the next couple turns, having them not 100% sure whether or not you're on, you know, is a Delver, a mono blue Delver, or, you know, even a red deck wins that has a slow start, you know. Not being able to decide which one you're on can really throw off early cantrips and early decisions.
This was also part where we saw the use of Aven Rift Watcher as an alternate way to gain infinite life aside from the Godfarer's Faithful. So flickering the Aven Rift Watcher is another way to go infinite on life.
Yeah, I think that's a much faster way to do it than just relying off Godfarer's Faithful and other things. It also gives you a strong blocker that can kind of cover things in the air as well as the ground.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's in the sideboard, not the main board. So it definitely is something that I think that deck wants to bring in when it knows it's going to be good. But yeah, I think that's definitely a card that is very good in the situation where it's going to be good, where you know you're going to have time to deploy it, and it's going to be able to block some creatures in the air for a little bit, and then when you have your combo set up, get you there much faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, getting that extra life swing from 2 when it enters as well as 2 when it leaves is a very powerful way to use that card.
Yeah, even if you don't combo off, gaining 4 mana off of playing a dude that'll probably block a creature or two is a decent way to buy some time.
Yeah, 4 life is a big swing.
And next up, we have round 5. Round 5 was an Is It Delver Mirror match. This one ended up going to Peter. And this was, being an Is It Delver Mirror match, this was a big back and forth. And as with any sort of control mirror match, these sort of tempo deck mirror matches, it's a lot of presenting threats and then nothing happening. You're just playing cards, you're doing a whole bunch of stuff, each player's playing 2 or 3 cards a turn, but nothing's actually happening. Nothing changes.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely more of a war of resources with you know, trying to draw a little bit harder than your opponent, get a few more cards in your hands for that eventual counter war that will decide the game, right?
Oh yeah.
You're trying to stockpile those resources.
It's all building up to the one big counter war on like turn 9, and then whoever wins the counter war is often going to go on to win the match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely less about board presence, more about the mental game and the resources you're able to build up in the early.
It's definitely a matchup that I enjoy playing a lot more than I enjoy watching. Watching it is fairly boring because it is Drago quite a lot. But as a player playing in that situation, playing those control mirror matches, playing those Delver mirror matches, yeah, it's a lot of sort of little things, little optimizations and jockeying for position, sort of managing your scries and your cantrips, that it's a lot of little micro decisions that will have ripple effects throughout the match and managing your resources. And it's definitely a good match to play, but for tournament sort of viewing, for being a feature match, it definitely is a whole lot of Drago building up to one big turn where everything happens and somebody concedes.
Yeah, definitely not the most entertaining from a spectator perspective. In round 6, we had Is It Blitz versus Slivers. This was a pretty interesting match. We saw Lauren Mulligan here using protection from Apostle's Blessing to work all around with Journey to Nowhere on the stack to force her opponent to exile one of their own creatures, right? By protecting your creature, you have to target something with Journey.
Yeah, this is one of the plays that you can do with things like Skyfisher, Journey to Nowhere, these cards that have to have a target, that they just bounce or exile a permanent. They must pick a target. if you can bounce something before they come into play or give your creatures protection or deal with something when they're on the stack, then that changes how many targets are legal once they actually enter play. And this was definitely a great play coming out of Lauren to use protection on her own creature to force them to exile one of their slivers to the Journey to Nowhere.
Yeah, it definitely shows that Lauren's a very strong player of the game.
We also had Standard Bearer showing up out of the Slivers deck here, and it definitely mucks up the game plan of Blitz more than many decks, because you can no longer target your own creatures with Teemer Battle Rage, you can no longer target your creatures with Fling, you struggle to handle just playing the game moving forward once there's a Standard Bearer in play.
It's definitely a house against those Voltron-style decks that are really trying to suit up one creature and get in, but it also works well against Blitz, who's a little bit less about targeting their own creatures with spells, but just having spells cast that benefit things. But they do always have cards like Timmy Battle Rage, or even, I'm pretty sure they still run a couple unblockable cards like Artful Dodge or Distortion Strike that really need to be cast on their own creature when they want to cast it on their own creature, and messing up with that targeting is extremely powerful for the decks that are able to do it.
Yeah, we definitely, I think this tournament overall, we saw a lot of copies of Standard Bearer in the top 16 decks. There was a lot of copies of Standard Bearer, and with the way this tournament in particular played out and sort of the field that it was in, Standard Bearer was definitely an MVP almost any time it was cast. There was one time later in the tournament in the final match where Standard Bearer did not quite interact the way that the player had hoped against Jeskai. But largely in this tournament, any time we saw Standard Bearer hit the battlefield, it did a lot of work.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the most powerful sideboard cards we have in the format, and it's pretty much seen constant play since aggro decks have been a thing.
Next up, we have our cut to top 8 in the quarterfinals. We have Jeskai Familiar against Blue-Red Delver, going 2-0 to Familiars. This is a match where we saw a lot of life gain win con. That I don't think he ever actually killed his opponent in the match. This was just, I gain infinite life, what are you going to do about it? It definitely was the display of that I'm not winning, but you're not either.
I would definitely say that it was a sort of a back and forth a lot of the time. Like, you'd see him be pushed fairly far down, like almost down to lethal, and then he'd be bounced back up with a whole bunch of life gain and that kind of thing. So there was definitely a back and forth for a while, but it's just not a fight that the aggressive deck can really win unless they really punch through in one big swing.
Yeah, Travis definitely, I think throughout the tournament, he fell to one life multiple times. He got down to one several times in the tournament and was able to just claw back each time.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing with playing that style of deck, is you really have to exemplify that strategy of, you know, the only point of life that matters is the absolute last one, and anything before that you can trade that off to get some more advantage on your board, as long as you're able to get back up later.
So this next match here, the semifinals match, was my match of the night. This was super interesting to watch, as a lot of stuff happened. There was a lot of cool interactions, and it was, while the winner still won 2-0, it was never one-sided. There was always a way for both players to win. So this was definitely an interesting match. We had Jeskai Familiars versus Slivers.
So yeah, this is one of the decks that can actually really deal with the plan coming out of Familiars of just gain a ton of life. Because Slivers can just respond with, hey, I played my Virulent Sliver, and you're going to get a poison counter every turn. And if you get to 10, you're dead. Doesn't matter how much life you have.
Yeah, having a main board answer to infinite life is something nobody else in the tournament had, and this definitely gave a big advantage to Slivers.
Yeah, I would say it's almost impossible to get that in any other way in our format other than Slivers, and in fact, which doesn't exist.
This was a interesting match with a lot of back and forths. We actually saw at one point Travis went to one life and then was able to combo off and gain infinite life. The Slivers deck responded by playing Virulent Slivers and got Travis to 9 poison counters when Travis finally comboed off and was able to actually lock the Slivers players out of the game using the Stonehorn Dignitary, and then was able to slowly say, you can't play anymore, I'm going to eventually kill you by punching you with Moldrifters. So it was not only 1 life, but 9 poison.
Yeah, it's definitely a powerful set of tools the deck has to fight combat-focused decks, right? You know, you can do things like, I will gain infinite life. Well, you have a way around that. Well, I'm going to Stonehorn Dignitary, your combat steps away, and you can't even go to combat anymore. That also sees a lot of play. This didn't particularly happen in this tournament because the Familiars player didn't go up against a Tron player, but against something like Ulamog's Crusher that has Annihilator and can really get you, even if it doesn't do damage, those Annihilator triggers will eventually wear down your resources to the point you don't have lands to stop them from attacking anymore, right?
Yeah, you can flicker out creatures to prevent damage, but you can't stop that Annihilator.
Yeah, but in this case, you can use stuff like Stonehorn Dignitary and just do the same thing, where I'm just going to prevent you from having any combat steps, and you can't even go to combat to trigger Annihilator.
Yeah, the game 2, I think, was a incredibly back-and-forth match for this one. The Slivers player ended up having 2 Virulent Slivers right off the bat. Like, opening hand or top 8 cards out of their deck, 2 Virulent Slivers, which is, in this situation, ideally what you want. Because you know you're probably not winning through combat damage, but if you can get a few poison counters in early, that really puts the pressure on, because it means that even if he combos off, he's not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, it definitely puts that extra layer of pressure that other decks can't apply.
Unfortunately, for the Slivers player, Travis managed to have 3 snaps in his opening hand, and any creature-based deck is going to have a hard time fighting through 3 snaps.
Yeah, that's definitely a very powerful opening hand coming out of the Familiars player.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking, because you're watching this Jeskai Familiars deck just dominate the field for the entire tournament, and the Slivers deck comes out as the one bastion of hope who can actually deal with infinite life, and then the Familiar player rips 3 snaps, and it's just like, no, your first 3 turns of the game don't matter. They didn't happen.
Yeah, I would definitely say that style deck is extremely powerful into a meta that you know is going to be very aggro-focused. So if that was a read from Travis, I think it's a very good read on what to play into this type of format.
Oh yeah, this was definitely Familiar's tournament to win, with a super aggro-focused field, with very few control decks, very few Tron decks coming out to prevent any real opposition in the form of real counter magic or sort of reliable removal, that we found so many times creatures would get into play from the Familiar's deck and just never leave. There's no real removal to speak of outside of the occasional lightning bolt, and at that point we had flickers and stuff to try and keep them alive. But it really, there wasn't the decks that we saw on the field just were not presenting the right pressure on the right axis to deal with Familiars, and it was kind of a runaway victory in a lot of forms due to the meta. And yeah, if there was a meta call on that, if that was a sort of previous knowledge going into this tournament, that was definitely a great call from Travis.
So finishing up with the finals was, again, we've seen the same kind of matchup before. It's Familiars against Boggles, as in Familiars into an aggressive deck. The same kind of thing, the same kind of matchup. Game 1 was a slower start for Boggles, so that's already bad news into a deck that can just gain infinite life, and that's exactly what Travis does. He locks them out of the game and gains all of his life, and they can't do anything about it.
We did see Game 2, the one situation where Standard Bear was not quite as good as the player had hoped, that Will unfortunately forgot that Standard Bearer cares about your the interaction, that there is no interaction between Standard Bearer and Ghostly Flicker. That Ghostly Flicker only affects your creatures, your permanents, and he
can't possibly target.
Yeah, he was really hoping that Standard Bearer would stop Ghostly Flicker from doing things, but that is not how that works, unfortunately. And that was the one time out of the tournament we saw a standard bearer hit the battlefield and it did not immediately stop whatever the opponent was doing.
Yeah, it's definitely an unfortunate interaction from the Boggles player.
So, out of the field, aside from Slivers, sort of out of our top 16, what deck do you think had the next best chance of taking down Familiars? I think Slivers is definitely the next favorite due to having Poison, but who else do you think could have gotten there aside from that?
Slivers is very good. I think maybe something like we saw, I believe it was Is It Blitz out of Lauren Mulligan. In the 13th position. I think that could have potentially had it.
Being able to present a reasonable kill on turn 3 or 4.
Yeah, Tribe as well. Just get there before he can do anything. You know, a turn 2 kill at a Tribe would probably have been too fast for the Familiars deck.
Oh, yeah.
But that's really about it for a lot of the decks in the top 16. You know, we didn't really... Maybe Elves could have presented infinite damage. I'm not sure if that's something that the deck can really do.
Yeah,
but
I mean, if you assume that...
I don't think it's actually infinite. I think it's just a lot of damage.
Yeah, if you assume that the Elves deck is going to have as much time as they need to set up, the Elves can probably find a way to make infinite tokens. And at that point, it just comes down to, okay, we're going to draw. But... Mm-hmm. I think that
that's sort of the thing is I really think you have to get under this Familiars deck if you're going to beat it for what's in the top 8. I think maybe if we had seen like a Tron player do well and play against it, we might have seen them be able to pull something out with Annihilator.
Yeah, have a deck that actually has the counter spells and removal along with a reasonable late game win condition. Because a lot of these decks just have late game. They don't have the removal or the counter spells. They have one or the other.
Yeah, I think, you know, seeing maybe a line like we stop you from resolving a Stonehorn Dignitary for a few turns, even maybe Devious covering up it or that kind of thing to get it like properly exiled and out of here. And then we present a way of just chipping in damage until you can't stop us anymore.
Devious cover up would have definitely just blown out Familiars in a very real way.
Yeah, it's Devious cover up is extremely strong, and I expected to see quite a bit of play in the meta because it deals with decks that want to abuse Ghostly Flicker extremely well. Out of decks that are in that same kind of vein timeline wise, like. It's a strong play from control decks to say no to other late game value decks abusing their graveyard like that.
Yeah, when you're playing for the control decks in the control mirror against Tortured Existence, against Monarch, against these other decks that want to go past turn 12, it's a great game there because it not only exiles their cards so it's just not an issue for you later on, but it also buys you back some cards for you to reuse later that, oh, now I get a sixth copy of Counterspell where I would not have otherwise. And against a deck like this, Familiar's deck, it's definitely what you want to be seeing.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't really see a lot in the top 16 that could really answer this style of deck.
No. Seeing a lack of blue-black control, seeing a lack of Tron, really meant that, yeah, Familiars was well-positioned to sweep this tournament, and it did. And it did with extreme prejudice. Slivers was the only thing that really presented a meaningful fight for it, and that one came down to, honestly, card draw. That matchup really came down to just who drew better, and Travis drew better. And sometimes that's the thing, is winning tournaments is a lot about player skill and consistency and do you have the right deck. But to win a tournament, to go 5-0, 6-0, 8-0, what it takes to win a tournament, does take an extreme amount of luck as well. And we definitely saw not just good player skill and deck knowledge, but decent luck coming out of Travis that carried him through some of those tighter matches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even looking at like the metagame for the Pauper Challenge that happened on the 14th, I think there's even more of those style of decks that could beat this type of thing in the online meta. You know, you've got a very fast Goblins list at the number one position, as well as I think it was number 7 position, as well as you've got blue-black control, you've got Tron, you've got Is It Blitz, you've got Inside Out. You know, there's a lot of decks in this top 16 from the challenge that really could have set this deck back and, you know, taken it down a peg. A couple more Izzet Blitz decks further down, you know, there's another Tron deck. So there's definitely a lot more in the online meta that would really put this deck in its place.
And I want to give Travis the benefit of the doubt there here that this was a meta call, that this was, he knew what he was getting into. But whether this was purposeful or accidental, this was definitely the right deck for this tournament.
Yeah, the aggro decks that we do see pulling into the top eight here, they're all packing ways to deal with removal, right? You've got Double Standard Bear in the main out of Joe Pamir's Slivers. You know, you've got Boggles in two positions because they're naturally just good against removal-centric decks. So I think that the read was very much this is going to be an aggressive format that has a reasonable amount of removal. You know, a lot of stuff like what we see coming out of Boros and Izzet Delver, where those are decks that they play, they have aggressive threats that they can play out, but they also have things like Lightning Bolt and Scred and Galvanic Blast that can kind of deal with threats.
Yeah, when you're expecting most of the field to be packing Lightning Bolts, walking into it with a deck with white in it is a good call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even out of the Slivers deck, we also see Hallow coming out of the side to kind of even move around some of that damage a little more. They can kind of play around that even more.
Oh yeah, Hallow is an amazing card against any deck running red. Because not only does it prevent the damage, because it prevents damage regardless of where it's being targeted. If it's hitting a creature or you directly as Burn, it prevents that damage regardless.
Yeah, it's extremely strong against a number of meta decks. You know, you can even run it into something like Affinity and say, hey, you're flinging your big-ass guy at me, Hallow your fling.
Yeah, Hallow your fling, you know? Gain 30. You have no permanents in place.
It's a pretty big windfall for decks that can actually resolve it. And decks that care about getting damage through on a red source, it's extremely powerful.
And Hallow is actually a relatively new include for Slivers. It's an older card and has been around for a while, but I have noticed it did not always show up in Slivers list. That is a card that has started growing in popularity in the last few months. And whether that is because Boros Monarch has started showing up way more, that how good Monarch is and the Izzet Delver decks are means that you just assume that you're going to be running against red 50% of the time.
Yeah, it definitely means you hedge against a lot of things. It's sort of been a card that's been up and outside the meta for a little bit, and it's sort of the kind of thing that it can come in and it can be very powerful for your decks, but not a lot of people run it traditionally speaking in a lot of these lists.
And with all that being said, that will be it for this episode of The Edict. This is our tournament episode for Rags to Riches 22. Congratulations to Travis for taking this down and to all of the competitors for putting on a wonderful tournament, as well as to Card Kingdom and Mox Boarding House for hosting this Pauper tournament for us. We do not get to see many competitive level tournaments in the Pauper format, and any opportunity we get to see a bit higher level play is a good opportunity, in my opinion. If you guys have any suggestions or comments for the show, you can head over to castleofcommons.com/edict. There will be a form there where you can fill out and submit any feedback to us. Or you guys are more than welcome to come and hang out with us on the Discord and Reddit. So, with all that being said, thank you all for listening. Hope you all have a great day. Keep it common, and we'll see you next time.